From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Brianne Nadeau. She is a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 1. But joining us now is Ralph Northam. He is the governor of Virginia. Governor Northam, I know that both you and your wife had tested positive for COVID-19 back in September. So I'd like to acknowledge that and say that we're all glad that you're both better. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, Kojo, to you and Tom and to your listeners, thanks so much for having me today. And I just hope all of you are staying safe and healthy. And I appreciate you asking about Pam and me. You know, this virus is a dangerous virus. It's nothing to play around with. It's very, very contagious. And we were fortunate, as you know, to have mild cases, and we have completely recovered. But a lot of people out there haven't, and people have lost their lives, and we all as Virginians and Americans need to take this seriously.
You ordered tightened coronavirus restrictions last week as coronavirus infection numbers continue to surge in the region and across the globe. What's the picture like in Virginia right now, and how do the current restrictions compare to what we saw in the spring?
Well, we follow the data every day, Kojo, and, you know, our positivity rate is something that I pay a lot of attention to. Certainly as a doctor, I'm used to analyzing data. And, you know, we were up over 20% at one point several months ago. We got down as low as 5%. Now we're just above 7%. We had 2,544 new cases today, 16 additional deaths. The trends, Kojo, are not heading in a direction that I'm comfortable with. And so we've learned so much about this virus, still a lot to learn, obviously, but we know where the outbreaks are occurring and why they're occurring. And a lot of it is because people aren't following the guidelines that we have put in place. And they're very straightforward: to wear a mask. That's not asking for too much, to keep our distance, to not gather in crowds. And so we're seeing a really large spike in the 20 to 29 age group. And so that's why we took some measures to mitigate these increasing numbers by closing our bars or shutting down the sale of alcohol at 10 o'clock, closing restaurants at 12 o'clock. We've expanded our mask mandate down to age 5. And decrease crowds to 25 or less. We know that these work. We did this in the eastern part of the state a few months ago. It was very effective. And so that's why we chose to do what we did. But the main thing, Kojo, this is all about behavior. And it's in our hands, as of course in our case as Virginians, but Americans, to do the right thing, to keep these numbers down, to keep that curve flat, as we talk about, and really to keep our hospital capacities where they need to be. Our workers in our hospitals and clinics, they're tired, Kojo. They're putting their lives at risk every day. They've been doing this for 9 months. And so it's just important for all of us to be part of the solution moving forward.
Here's Tom Sherwood.
Hey, Governor, thanks for being with us today. You know, you're a doctor, and I know you've got that nice, soft bedside manner when you discuss the most horrific things. But, you know, over in Maryland, Governor Hogan is screaming, "Wear the damn mask." And I'm just wondering if your nice Southern polite style is getting the message through about how dangerous this is. For example, what will you be doing to celebrate Thanksgiving with your family? What would just be you and Pam?
It's a great question. And first of all, I am a doctor, and I try to provoke calmness when I do things. And I think for the most part, Tom, Virginians have done very well. They have followed the guidelines. Again, there are, I think, a lot of young folks, and we've been there, once we were invincible. So we need to continue to to educate, to put that message out, that this isn't only about, you know, the young folks, it's about, you know, their families, their loved ones, and that's why it's so important to follow these guidelines. And I, you know, the CDC came out yesterday, and I appreciate what they did, and I follow their guidelines closely to if you don't have to please not travel during Thanksgiving. I'm planning on spending, hopefully, a quiet and restful Thanksgiving with my immediate family, and really follow the guidelines that we have put in place and encourage others to follow.
If I can ask just a money question, everyone mostly has been disappointed that the Congress has not done a second stimulus package. There's been suggestions that maybe during the lame duck session, Congress might get around to a $1.5 trillion stimulus package. How important is it for the Congress and the president to act to help out not only Virginia, but the district and Maryland and every other jurisdiction across the country? Do you think something will happen before Joe Biden takes over in January?
Well, it's very important, Tom. And, you know, one of the things that governors have had to face, we've been fighting this biological war now for close to 9 months with really no leadership coming from Washington. And, you know, whether it's PPE or testing, you know, we just haven't had the guidance that we have needed, and especially the messaging. And it's unfortunate that just the simple fact of wearing a mask has become so political. But we know why this is happening, and we'll continue to, you know, to promote our message. But to your question about the CARES Act funding, we have used that to a great benefit in Virginia. We've, you know, put $220 million in K-12 to help them prepare for their testing and keeping our children safe. We put money in higher education, money in a program called Rebuild Virginia that's helping small businesses get back on their feet. And something that is very, very important as we move forward, and this is where I think the doctor in me can really help message this. I am very hopeful about the vaccination. The numbers look very good. And so we have been planning for a couple months in how to distribute that equitably across the Commonwealth. We're going to do it in different phases, and more will be said about that in the next couple of weeks. But so the CARES Act funding has been very beneficial. We would like to see more relief coming out of Washington. So we're hopeful that they will sit down at the table and put their political differences aside and do what's in the best interest of Americans. One last thing I would say, Tom, that is a real priority for our administration is the broadband. You know, because of COVID-19, we know even more now than before that how important this is. It is an equity issue. It's about access to business opportunities, access to healthcare through telemedicine, and access to virtual learning for our students. So we've put a significant amount of our resources, about $82 million this year, toward getting that last mile for folks across the Commonwealth for broadband.
Governor Northam, you recently announced that you support the legalization of marijuana. This comes after the General Assembly decriminalized marijuana possession this year. You have supported decriminalization since you ran for governor in 2017. What would legalization do, and why do you now support it?
Well, I think Virginia is ready for legalization, Kojo. And as you said, we did introduce and pass decriminalizing marijuana last year. As a doctor, I've followed very closely the medicinal use of marijuana. And there are numerous uses for it out there. I look forward to collecting more data in that regard. I hope that the federal government can change the schedule from Schedule 1 so that we can do more and better research. But we want to move forward in Virginia with this, and we want to do it the right way. We have two studies that we're following very closely, and it's going to be done with equity. Kojo, I think a quick fact, you know, people of color and those of not, they use marijuana at the same rate. People of color are three times more likely to get arrested and convicted. So we want equity to be a part of this. I, as a pediatrician, certainly want to protect our youth. We want to maintain our clean indoor air policy, which I worked on with smoking in restaurants. And then finally, we really want to do a good job of collecting data and be able to measure our progress as we move forward. But I think it's all about timing. There probably 15 or so other states that have moved toward legalizing marijuana. Virginia will be the first in the South. But, you know, we tend to be leaders, and that's what we're going to do this year, and we're going to do it the right way.
We got a tweet from Roger. Governor, with the marijuana legalization, would you allow people to grow their own personal plants, like 3 for personal use? And do you plan on allowing more adult fireworks like Pennsylvania?
Well, 2 questions there, Kojo. I am not, as a pediatrician, a big fan of fireworks. Those need to be in the hands of professionals that do it every day. As far as growing marijuana personally, you know, at the home, that's something that we're looking into. We're looking at what other states have done. The bottom line is, you know, if we're going to do that, we want it to be done safely. Now, you could make the argument or the point that, you know, we're able to brew beer in our home, so why not grow marijuana? I've heard that. I understand that. But it's something that, again, we want to do this the right way. There's going to be a lot of people at the table to discuss how we move forward, and that's certainly part of the discussion that we'll undertake as we move forward with this.
Here's Manny in Reston, Virginia. Manny, you're on the air. Don't have a lot of time. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Big supporter of Governor Northam. I only had one question in reference to gyms and fitness centers. It still sounds very illogical to me to limit the restaurants and other facilities in terms of the number of attendees, but the gyms are getting the carte blanche in terms of not wearing a mask and show up in mass quantities of people, even though there's a limitation on the lower side, as I have read in your statement and decree. The question is, when is that going to change? I think this is
Governor Northam, can you respond?
Yes, that's a great question, Manny. And, you know, we are following that. We are encouraging the, you know, limited number of occupants in gymnasiums. And also the distancing is so important, especially when, you know, people are exercising, they're breathing harder. There's more of a risk to disperse you know, the virus should they be infected with it. So we are following that closely. But and the issue of wearing a mask, you know, when you're exercising, sometimes it's difficult because you want to get as much oxygen and as you can. So we do encourage, though, the distancing and being as safe as we can, cleaning equipment when you're through with it, all of those types of things. But we want to, you know, Manny, we want people to continue to be able to exercise and stay healthy. And it also helps our mental health, which is a whole nother issue as part of this pandemic. And we are aware of that.
And I'm afraid that's about all the time we have with Governor Northam. Ralph Northam is the governor of Virginia. He is a Democrat. Governor Northam, thank you very much for joining us, and stay safe.
Kojo, you and Tom and all your viewers, our listeners, thanks for having me. You stay safe and healthy as well, and I hope to be with you in person soon.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, Brianne Nadeau, a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 1, joins us. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back. Joining us now is Brianne Nadeau, a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 1. Councilmember Nadeau, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Kojo. Glad to be here.
Before we get questions specifically for Councilmember Nadeau, Tom Sherwood, we have some leftover business from Virginia from before, and that is former Virginia House Speaker Kirk Cox says he'll be seeking Ralph Northam's job next time around. Of course, Northam is term limited. So it's open for Kirk Cox. Thinks he has a good chance?
Well, the Republicans haven't done so well since 2008, 2009. But, you know, Kirk Cox is certainly a conservative. He is a more moderate conservative than the only other Republican candidate for governor right now. That's Amanda Chase, a state senator in suburban Richmond, who is trying her very best to mimic the Trump approach to state politics. I think Kirk Cox will try to be seen more in the middle, but that's an interesting race for the Republicans. They're still having internal fights about how Trump-like they want to be, and do they want to move back to the middle and capture some of those suburban voters who have abandoned them recently. So that's an interesting race to watch.
And we were talking with Governor Northam about his efforts to stem the coronavirus pandemic in Virginia. Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland some months ago highly touted that a batch of 500,000 coronavirus tests had been obtained from Korea with some assistance from his wife, who is Korean. He even wrote about it in his memoir. Now, it turns out that that batch of coronavirus tests were flawed and never used. What say you?
Yes, that's a big story from the Washington Post just within the last hour. You know, he got international publicity last April when he arranged to have these 500,000 tests flown in from Korea. But then all summer long, people were saying, well, what happened? How are they being used? Where are they going? There was all these muddled answers from the governor. Now the Washington Post, Steve Thompson, has told us they didn't work, and they had to just give them away. I forgot exactly what happened to them, but the state had to pay $2.5 million to the same firm to replace the test. So that's a $12 million investment that will not look good on the governor's record when he leaves office in a couple of years. It's just an embarrassment for the governor, and the Post asked the governor's office to respond, and basically the governor's office did not respond. I would say it's a variety of things. The Purple Line and a couple of other things are not looking good for Governor Hogan, and I'd love to be able to talk to him if he'd appear on this show.
I know you also love talking with Peter Francho, exchanging barbs with him. Well, you're going to get a lot of opportunities to do that, it would appear, because Peter Francho is campaigning for governor of Maryland, and he says, according to Bruce DePoit of Maryland Matters, that he's going to become campaigning for governor like a tiger, which is not exactly how his personality seems to come across. But what are his chances?
Well, he's the most popular elected official in the state of Maryland and probably the least popular in the Annapolis hall of the legislature. So it's interesting. But, you know, he's out early. The race is technically not until 2022. Governor Hogan can't run for reelection. There's, at this point, not yet a strong Republican candidate running. You know, but, you know, there are several people who might run in this race. I think Peter Francho just wants to get out there early. He gave that interview you just mentioned with Bruce DePoit in Maryland Matters is really quite good. He lays out exactly what he's going to do, how he's going to do it, when he's going to do it. And so he's all fired up. It's just an early firing warning shot at the beginning of that campaign.
Councilmember Nadeau, the Metropolitan Police Department accrued $43 million in overtime expenses this summer responding to protests. You're leading a push to increase council oversight of that spending. Why? Because you know there's going to be the pushback that says you're trying to tie the hands of the MPD in responding to major events like this past weekend's large pro-Trump rally. What say you?
Well, asking for more information certainly doesn't tie anyone's hands, right? We're not telling them what to do. My legislation is meant to get more information, more transparency, and more accountability. So the council has an oversight role, and that's what I'm doing here.
And the mayor, of course, is pushing back, saying you should withdraw your bill. Where are the funds to pay for the overtime costs coming from?
Well, just to be clear, the bill passed Tuesday, so that's happened already. And the funds that the mayor reprogrammed to cover the cost of overtime for the most recent overtime expenditures came from the Department of Healthcare Finance, which is where Medicaid is. It's where the Alliance healthcare benefit for our immigrants is. It came from the Child and Family Services Agency, $2 million, when they have wait lists right now for some of their parenting programs and grandparenting programs, and the Workforce Investment Fund. And these are places that, you know, in a pandemic, we need to ensure we are not taking money away from the critical programs that people need.
Now, let me cut to the chase before Tom Sherwood intervenes, and that is, there seems to be a suspicion on your part that the police might be padding their overtime bills. Is that your concern?
I don't know that they're padding it, but I do want to know how they're spending their funds, right? There's no accusation here. It's a wanting a better understanding of how and when overtime overspending occurs. And we just don't have access to day-to-day spending in the way that we need to understand the trends and to understand when we're about to go over budget. And that's what we need to know as a council.
Tom Sherwood.
Well, thanks for coming on the show today. I appreciate it. Some people would say, you know, the whole $16 billion government spend's millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars in overtime, but they're not having to report every couple of months. Let me ask you, you tweeted about the police department in this overtime spending. You said, "I express my disapproval to the idea that the police department's reckless overspending and over-policing of our communities should be prioritized above health and human service programs." That's earlier this month. What does over-policing mean in a city that where the murder rate is 22% higher this year than last year? It's on pace to be the worst murder rate since 2005, 180 people dead this year. Car theft is up 46%. Assaults with a dangerous weapon with guns up 19%. You've criticized reckless overspending and over-policing. How would you address these statistics I just cited? And these are from yesterday.
Well, that's a lot to unpack. So let's take a couple steps back. First of all,
people are saying you're anti-police.
Right, which is not true. But we have more police in the District of Columbia per capita than almost anywhere in the country. And that has not reduced the murder rate. And this council and I have focused on allocating funding to things that prevent violence, investing in people, investing in programs that actually reduce violence, right?
But so that's long term, isn't it?
Not necessarily. We have violence interrupters on the streets who mitigate conflict ongoing as it's going. However, this bill was about the peaceful protests this summer. You know, we are still waiting on the investigative reports from May 31st and June 1st, where my constituents were kettled on Swan Street. I have constituents from other peaceful demonstrations that have been shot in the eye with rubber bullets. I have one constituent who has had multiple surgeries since that happened. And these are peaceful protesters, right? So that's what we're taking issue with, in particular with the overtime spending with First Amendment demonstrations that have not been peacefully handled by police. And looking at this overtime spending helps give us a bigger picture of how we're using police resources and what alternatives might exist once we've analyzed that information.
What are the alternatives? Yes, there are all those peaceful protests and legitimate criticism of police actions there, but also I've seen the video and I've been at these protests where there in fact is violence. And if that are you not saying that overtime should be eliminated for the violent incidents that occur?
Of course not. But here's the thing. We need more transparency with the police department, bottom line, right? And that is what this bill is about. This bill is about information. Yeah.
Well,
we only got about 30 seconds left.
Okay. Police chief, he has to go before the council for reappointment next spring. Will you support the police chief Newsom being reappointed if the mayor submits his name again?
That has a lot to do with what happens between now and then. We're in ongoing conversation with the chief about transparency and accountability. He said in his conversations with me, he agrees the police department has too much responsibility right now. I want to make good on the beginning of that conversation to carry it through. Yeah.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Brianne Nadeau. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Our guest is Brianne Nadeau, a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 1. The U.S. Attorney for D.C., Michael Sherwin, announced yesterday that his office will not be prosecuting the D.C. police officer or charging him who fatally shot Dion Kay this summer because the U.S. Attorney's office says it could not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Officer Alexander Alvarez broke federal law. As I recall that incident, Dion Kay may have had a gun in his possession or was attempting to throw it away at the time. What's your response to this decision?
Well, it's heartbreaking, of course, especially for Dion Kay's family. And this one was really difficult. What I can say from the perspective of a council member who's doing oversight is, you know, the law that we passed earlier this year allowed for a quick investigation, allowed for that footage to be available. And I know that this wasn't the outcome that everybody wanted. But I think that we are, you know, at least moving towards more transparency for the public so they can understand when a U.S. attorney makes a decision like that, what they're basing the facts on.
Well, most of our next calls fall under the heading, the rent is too damn high. So allow me to start with Yolanda in Ward 1. Yolanda, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I just wanted to ask what your position is on canceling rent for people who were housing insecure before the pandemic, and especially those who do not qualify for ERAP funding.
Okay, Councilmember Nadeau, hold your response to that question because Jorge, also in Ward 1, has a similar question. Jorge, your turn.
Thank you. I applaud you for your efforts in gaining oversight with regard to police spending, but I also would like to explore with you in a forum, an open forum, regarding rent forgiveness in D.C. I don't qualify for many of these programs. I'm 73 years old, living here 40 years, and I would like your assistance in that.
Councilmember Nadeau.
Yolanda and Jorge both have really important questions. The pandemic's been hard for a lot of people. We recently expanded ERAP so that more people are eligible, and we know that that's still not enough. We can't cancel rent writ large because we also need landlords to be able to run their properties. So it's a tough position to be in. So the focus that I've had is making sure that we are getting subsidy to as many people as we can, and really pushing our landlords to work out individually with folks who can't access that subsidy, other arrangements. It really does have to be case by case because we need folks who can pay rent to do so that our housing does not deteriorate while we're waiting for the pandemic to end. But I've been really focused on this. So I oversee ERAP. It's part of the Department of Human Services. It's something we run out of funding for every year. So every year I've expanded the funding for it. We now have federal dollars for additional funding through the Department of Housing. And so it's really critical to me that we are getting money out the door to people who need it, and that we don't let any of that go to waste because it's a critical time to be helping people remain in their homes.
On a broader issue involving rent, here is Gary, also in Ward 1. Gary, your turn.
Hey, Brian. We desperately need stronger rent control, as outlined in the Reclaim Rent Control Coalition. I know people have been organizing for over 2 years to push it through, and I know you've been an ally to help with that, and we appreciate it. But I don't see how we stop gentrification and displacement without it. You know, who's holding this up in the council, and what do activists and you know, citizens of D.C. need to do to really make it clear that their constituents really want this?
Hi, Gary. So we had a hearing last week on the bill that Councilmember Trayon White and I introduced that is the Reclaim Rent Control platform. And this bill would close some loopholes. It would expand the number of housing units that are currently that would be under rent control, close off some exemptions to certain properties. I think it's a really important piece of legislation, and it's a really important platform. It's in the Housing Committee. It's had a hearing. My hope is that it'll move forward. And, you know, the challenge is that rent control was reauthorized this year, which I support, but without any improvements. And we know there are challenges with the way rent control currently runs. And my hope was to amend the reauthorization as it went through, but unfortunately it was swept into the Budget Support Act. So instead, I introduced this bill so that we really can improve the existing rent control laws and expand rent control to additional properties in the district.
Thank you very much for your call, Gary, Yolanda, and Jorge. Tom Sherwood.
Thank you. Councilmember, you represent Ward 1, the heart of the city, probably the most diverse part of the city, but I was looking at demographics. You know, 10, 15 years ago, it's like 48% black and 30-something percent white. Those numbers have been virtually reversed, and I think I saw somewhere recently the Office of Planning, your ward now is almost 55% white. There's maybe 20% Hispanic, Latino, or Latinx. Are you running for re-election in 2022?
How does that have to to do with the rest of the question?
Well, one, I'd like to know. And secondly, there are some people who, in this past election, the Hispanic, Latino, and Latinx candidates were blown out by all the other candidates. Yeah. Maybe is there time for a Latino member of to represent Ward 1 on the council?
Ah, I see where you're going. Okay. Well, you know.
I wrapped it together for you.
Thanks. I was waiting. I knew you usually put a bow on it, Tom. Okay. So I do represent, I believe, still one of the most diverse wards in the District of Columbia, and I'm really proud of that. I have spent the past 6 years and even before that ensuring that I'm hearing the voices of the residents that I represent that don't look like me, right? As a white woman who only moved here about 20 years ago, I know that, you know, my life experiences are not the same as everyone I represent, but I've really prided myself on ensuring that I'm hearing those voices and lifting them up. When it comes to the Latino community, I've been a tireless advocate for everything related to immigrants in our community. I've worked with all our small business owners, ensuring they have resources. You know, our Latino community cares about the same things many others do, which is good education, affordable housing. I mean, these are things that I've focused on. So if I do run and I have a challenge, I look forward to debating those issues then. But let's let the ink dry on the 2020 results before we have that conversation.
DC never.
Can I ask a political question about the council? You know, one change is that the council that will be taking seats in January will be that there will be a majority female council for the first time since 1998, and it will be the majority black for the first time since 2012, I believe. And you are chair of the Human Services Committee, appointed by the chairman, Phil Mendelson. He will make reassignments of committees by the end of December. Do you want to remain as chair of the Human Services Committee, or are you looking to take on new responsibilities?
I've really appreciated the opportunity to chair the Human Services Committee. In the just a few years that I've been chair, I've reformed TANF, I've reformed homeless services, I've created more rights for people with disabilities, and I'm really proud of that work. If I have the opportunity to continue doing it, I know there's a lot more we can do. And my focus right now is on ending chronic homelessness. And I've had the opportunity to do that not only at the council, but at the regional coalition of governments for Metro Washington as chair of their committee. I think we have a lot more work to do there, but wherever the chairman assigns me, I will be very pleased to serve.
What is your relationship? Quickly, what's your relationship with the chairman? You sometimes are his most severe critic on the council, depending on what the issue is. How are you and he getting along?
Oh, you know what? So one of the things that I love about being a DC council member is that you never know who you're going to agree with on any given day. But as long as we can be respectful of one another, then we can work together. And chairman and I don't always agree, but we always are able to work together.
Well, there
you
are some
respect each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Well, there are some people who think you can't predict how many of the council members are going to agree with anything on any particular day, because when she joined for her debut on the Politics Hour, Christina Henderson mentioned that women leaders lead differently and that the council being majority female will have a real impact. What do you think of that assessment and the assessment that the new members of the council will push the council to the left?
So there is evidence that when women lead and in office, issues like paid family leave, issues like education, issues that impact families and people in poverty get lifted up in a way that they aren't otherwise. And so I'm thrilled that we're going to have a female majority again on the council. It is not the first time. There have been female majorities on the council many times in history, and it's actually just recently, it's kind of unusual that we haven't had one. So I'm excited to be back there. I think it's going to be even more collegial and inspiring than it's been.
Okay, here is Heather in Eastern Maryland. Heather, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you for taking my call, Councilwoman. Thank you so much for giving me a chance to touch base with you. Going back to the bill that you're proposing for clarity with our police spending, this might seem a little unusual, but do you believe that the pandemic gives you a little boost when it comes to public support where I base that out of is during the pandemic, especially when it first began, we just kept hearing we don't have enough money for protective gear. We don't have enough money to take care of our people in the healthcare industry and the people who really need it. But then when the peaceful protests came along, all of a sudden we had plenty of money for rubber bullets, tear gas, things like that. I know I never was really curious about public spending or even police spending until I really made that correlation. So do you think others will make that correlation and show you support for that bill?
Well, Heather, I think you kind of answered your own question, right? Because that's how you're perceiving it. I'm sure a lot of others perceive it that way. You know, for me, when you're dealing with a budgetary reprogramming, it becomes very clear what things are being prioritized. So in this case, it was millions of dollars from the Healthcare Finance Agency. It was a couple million dollars from a child welfare agency and money from our Workforce Investment Fund. And that just is such a striking juxtaposition to police activity that it really drove the point home for me.
Thank you very much for your call, Heather. D.C. never entered phase three of reopening, and Mayor Muriel Barzo announced this week that we should expect new coronavirus restrictions soon. She hasn't announced them yet. What new restrictions would you like to see?
Well, Kojo, I follow the daily case counts and the numbers, and I'm always interested in where our case tracking is telling us that the cases are coming from. We know that folks are really letting their guard down when it comes to small gatherings with family and friends, and that a quarter, at last I checked, a quarter of the infections are coming from those. So we really need people to be cautious about their own behavior and their gatherings. Another 25% last time I was looking was from restaurants and bars. And so we certainly need to examine that, right? And what's causing that and why those are the things that we're looking at least from my perspective from oversight. I'm looking at the numbers the Department of Health is sending out about where the infections are coming from. And that's what the focus needs to be on.
D.C. is ramping up testing, but people were already complaining about long lines at public testing sites in D.C. What do you think the district should be doing to address that?
Well, in our briefing this week, the Department of Health told us that they are going to continue beefing up the testing options. And one thing that we can do also is just encourage people who have other ways to get tested to do that. So, for example, if your doctor's office does testing and you can make an appointment and do that rather than standing in line, we'd encourage you to do that as well. The public testing site is, of course, there for anyone who needs it. But we also want to make sure for people who only have that option that it's there.
Tom Sherwood.
Thank you. I apologize. I cannot remember. Did you vote yes or no to overturn Initiative 77, which was the voter-approved measure to get rid of tipped wages for workers and just have everyone have the same minimum wage? I can't remember. 2018.
I voted against overturning it, Tom.
Right. That's what I was thinking, that you were against overturning it. It passed the voters by 55 to 45. Do you think the new council coming into place in January might take a second look at that bill and that initiative and maybe bring it back up?
I don't know. You're the first person to mention that to me. And it's hard to say what the new council will take up. But I look forward to having those conversations with all my new colleagues, because I'm excited about the new energy coming. And I could certainly see us taking on something like adequate wages for our restaurant workers.
No follow up. Here's John in Logan Circle. John, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for having me on this show. And thank you, council member, for taking my question. This is John. We've known each other for quite a while, Councilmember Nadeau. And the question is really in concerns the legislation that was just passed over the overtime spending. And traditionally, hasn't the federal government reimbursed the MPD for any of the overtime for protests? And that this administration, for you know, whatever reason, maybe wanting to, you know, penalize or hurt the district, has not. So that where the police traditionally stay within their budget. So it seems to be a reaction to the $43 million currently, and that the money that was taken from the different federal critical services is, again, the result of the federal government not reimbursing us. So couldn't the same oversight questions or reports, which are absolutely reasonable, be handled at an oversight hearing?
Here's the challenge with this type of overtime spending. It happens really quickly, right? I mean, and it can happen without anyone expecting it. And when we expect that the federal government's going to reimburse us, if they do, we're fine. If they don't, then we find ourselves in this situation. And so the council has the right and should have the ability to be able to more closely monitor something that has been overspent, especially to such a large degree, and in close to real time. Because ultimately, we also play a role in budgeting, and an oversight of police in particular, the public has made very clear, is critically important to them. So in my mind, there's just really no reason to push back on the council asking for more information on a regular basis. We don't have the ability to tell the mayor how to spend the money once the budget has been passed, but we do have the right and the responsibility to monitor the spending.
Thank you very much for your call. We were talking earlier about how the council has changed and how the new members might affect it. Brianne Nadeau, Christina Henderson, who was in a field with more than 20 candidates, says one of the first bills she will introduce will be one of ranked choice voting. You actually co-introduced a ranked choice voting amendment back in 2019. Do you think that now this is something the D.C. Council will pass?
I really hope we will. I mean, it was a good idea then. It's a good idea now. As far as I can tell, it's never been a bad idea. It just hasn't had, there hasn't been enough time to take it up. And so I hope that we can. I'm thrilled to hear that the council member-elect Henderson is going to lead with that. I think it's a great piece of legislation.
Tom Sherwood, how does ranked choice voting work?
Ranked choice voting is when you go into the when you vote, whenever you vote, however you vote. If you have 10 candidates running for office, you maybe will select the three you want, the first choice, second choice, and third choice. And if no candidate gets up to 50%, then the people who are the lowest on the vote totals drop out, and your second choice is considered until someone gets 50%. It's not as complicated as I just made it.
Here is
the data. The idea is that in these at-large races, you have you have people winning with a pretty small percentage of the vote, and typically more people voted for everyone else than the person who won. Right?
Yes, Christina Henderson won with 15%.
Yeah, voters want to feel good about knowing that the person who is taking the seat got a significant number of votes and is really representative of the voices of the district.
Can I ask one more election question?
Sure.
There were a lot of complaints around the June primary and the special election in Ward 2 about the ability of the Board of Elections, three-member board, to actually be up to speed on everything that needs to be done. It worked out better in the fall. Do you think we need a new board? I don't think any of the three members have any experience running elections except what they've done on the board. Do we need a different kind of elections board so we don't have any of these problems going forward?
I honestly haven't thought about that, specifically the structure. What I have thought about is, you know, how responsive the Board of Elections has been to the needs of the pandemic. You know, you may know that I'm the author of the vote by mail bill.
Which is actually a very good thing. It worked out really well.
It worked out well. I think, look, what we saw, was everything perfect? No. But did the Board of Elections learn from June? Absolutely. I found them to be very responsive this time around when folks couldn't find their ballots, et cetera. I thought the technology was good, the ballot trackers. I thought the siting of the boxes. We didn't have any problems that I heard of at the polling locations. So I do think that they ultimately rose to the occasion, despite June being pretty challenging.
Here is David in Washington, D.C. David, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey there, Kojo and the gang. Thank you for having me. I was calling about the Airbnb legislation that passed last year, which I can say with confidence passed thanks to in great part to the hotel lobby's influence. But it was initially passed with the rationale that short-term rentals were limiting access to affordable housing, but nobody ever presented any data to show that. Now that so many people have left the district because of COVID and rents are down as much as 20% or even more than they were last year, would you, Councilmember Netto, support doing a study of showing how short-term rentals actually do affect rent prices and whether there might be a possibility of changing the legislation so that people who depend on Airbnb income can get through a difficult time like this?
Well, certainly the pandemic has made us rethink a lot of things, but I do want to clarify that for me, the argument wasn't necessarily about affordable housing stock. It was about overall housing stock. It's that if we have usable housing units that are being tied up with short-term rentals, then those units aren't available for rent to anyone, no matter what their income is. And it just destabilizes the entire housing market and, you know, can impact every price of housing from the top down. There was some study I believe the DC Policy Center looked at this. I doubt that there's an appetite to take this up again, but I do think that, you know, we'll probably be revisiting a whole host of things after this pandemic just to make sure that everything in the housing and I would say office buildings as well, all of our stock is calibrated with the needs of the district and where the workforce is.
Well, with your and Councilmember Treon's bill to expand rent control, it's received pushback from landlords and developers who argue that expanding rent control would mean less tax revenue for the city and lower property values. And there are some small landlords struggling to make ends meet during the pandemic who would be subject to this new bill. We got an email from Margarita who says, why should landlords pay the price because the city demolishes affordable housing? The mayor is the principal gentrifier. How would you respond to those concerns?
Those are interesting assertions. I mean, the rent control bill that Councilmember White and I introduced is about expanding the properties that are covered under rent control so that we can preserve affordability on existing housing. I do agree.
You only have about a minute left, but go ahead.
Okay. I agree that, well, maybe I'm not agreeing. I believe the government does need to put some skin in the game, right? Right now, the burden of rent increases in rent control property is on the tenants alone. And landlords surely do need that revenue. So my thinking is that government needs to put some skin in the game. Perhaps we need a fund that helps offset the difference between rents paid and what the landlord needs to make ends meet. But we definitely, the system right now is not working. And that's why I wanted to change it. That's why I was so disappointed that the rent control got reauthorized without any improvements at all. So this bill is meant to move us closer to a better workable rent control system. And perhaps not all pieces of it will pass, but I do think there's some really valid pieces of it.
And I'm afraid that's just about all the time we have. Breanne Nadeau is a member of the DC Council representing Ward 1. She's a Democrat. Breanne Nadeau, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Today's Politics Hour was produced by Sidney Grannon. Coming up Monday, Hyattsville Mayor Candace Hollingsworth is resigning at the end of the year to form a new black-centric political party. We ask about what she learned as mayor and what she plans for this new party. Plus, Lamar Giles didn't see black main characters in the books he read as a kid, so he grew up to write them into his own award-winning novels for tweens and teens. He's the next guest in our Kojo for Kids series that all starts at noon on Monday. Until then, have a wonderful and safe weekend. Any big plans, Tom Sherwood?
It's nice weather. Be safe and enjoy the weather outside.
I endorse that all. Thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Julie Deppenbrock, Sidney Granite, Lauren Marco, Kurt Gardiner, Richard Cunningham, and Ines Renike. Our managing producer is Ingalisa Schroepsdorf. Our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. Today's engineer was Mike Kidd. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.